Hi, this is Jay Gambit from Crowhurst. You are listening to Toilet of Hell Radio.
You're listening to 66.6 FM. Radio TOVH. The Flush.
Thing before we get started, I gotta know, is it Crowhurst or Crowhurst?
Crowhurst.
I was wrong. Jordan was right.
Yay.
Yeah, Crow is a really, really good other noise project that is not by me. Crowhurst is just Donald Crowhurst was an amateur sailor who attempted to sail around the world, but instead went crazy.
Oh. Huh.
As one does.
He wasn't equipped to do what he thought he was going to do. And then whatnot. Made for a good bleak story to name a project after.
Yeah, I respect the hustle. You know, he didn't quite have the commitment to get there, but he had the heart to try.
Yeah, exactly. He was just a little ill-equipped. Probably should have practiced a bit more. If anything, Crowhurst is a code for the pitfalls of not practicing.
Ooh, good. So, Jordan and I were just talking about this before we called you up because, I mean, your primary thing with Crowhurst is, I mean, you put out a lot of noise albums, and you also put out, I guess, the first one was the self-titled, and then you followed it up with two, which were more structured, like full instrumentation metal records. So, I guess, do you practice the noise records, or do you just practice the metal records, or how does your practice structure work?
Well, we don't practice anything. I mean, the first Crowhurst record was written like a traditional band does, but even that was born out of, I mean, if you look on YouTube, we had been jamming, and I would meet people and say, all right, let's meet at the venue on stage. We go on at 8. I'll see you at 7:45. And I'm usually shaking somebody's hand, you know, and saying, all right, it's good to meet you. I enjoy how you play. Let's see how it goes together. And that's how the one lineup came to be. You know, a lot of times venue owners would be like, wow, that was a crazy set. And I was like, yeah. And they're like, how long have you been playing together? I'm like, whoa. What time is it now? 9:00. So about an hour and a half. But you know, it either works or it doesn't. But with the second album, Andy and I did it differently. I said to Andy, you know, here's exactly what the songs should sound like. And he, you know, sent them back to me exactly how they should sound. Andy likens it to when he asks me, like, hey, could you do a cover for me? And I go, yeah. And goes, all right, it needs to look like an amazing black and white, has to be, you know, kind of grainy. I want it to look like an asteroid, but I don't want it to look too specific. And I'm like, all right, gotcha. You know, I'll say to him, you know, it needs to have a normally kind of drum sound, but I want it to have, you know, some heavy riffs in it. And then the chorus needs to break down to a 3-4 part. Gotta have some like ballady undertones, and I'll be like, got it, and I'll deliver a track that sounds exactly like it. So that was the practicing for the second one, and we could call that practice for three, because when I went to the UK this time, you know, we had the experience of writing two together that kind of informed sitting next to each other and actually going, all right, well, if we could make the guitars a little bit frillier in this part, oh, cool, I really like what you're doing there, you know, oh, let's watch some Rammstein videos for riff inspiration, you know. So each of them were written out differently, and with the noise stuff, it's practice just generally comes from playing a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, I play a lot, or I used to at least, and I used to record a lot. That, you know, like when you get behind the wheel of a car, you know how you just kind of instinctively know where to go. And, you know, your hands know how far to move the wheel. You know, it's how your foot knows how much pressure to give the gas. It's the same thing with the noise records. You know, I have certain tools that I use, I have a Boss delay pedal that is like my primary tool. And I know the thing is now front to back. But I mean, when I think about, I have a show tonight with Bolzer, and
oh, that's wild.
I was sitting around. Yeah, it's going to be fun. It's Bolzer, Japan Spin Ritual, and Cemetery Piss. It's going to be a fun fucking show, but I have no idea what I'm going to do. I just know that it's going to be, I'm going to get up, probably plug my laptop in with a couple of effects pedals, hope for the best, you know. I don't know what tracks I'm playing, where I'm going to take it, if it's going to be rhythmic, if it's going to be droney, if it's going to be harsh. It'll probably end up being harsh at the end. But, you know, that's the part that is without practice, because if you practice improv too much, you become a one-trick pony. You're like, cool, I'm the dude who does this set. I'm the dude who does that set. Conceptually, you get a little stale. Like, as much as I love a solid, defined aesthetic, I just don't want to be known as the so-and-so guy.
So what does it feel like to get on stage, and do you know when you're killing it? Do you know when it's just not working out? What does that feel like?
I know when it's not working. I don't know when it's working, but I know when it's not working. I guess the absence of feeling like I did an absolutely shit show set is probably indicative. That's probably when I know. But I mean, my last set at Coaxial, Los Angeles, was like one of those things where you could tell by about minute 12 or 13 that we were like, all right, cool, this has been successful. Every transition I've made or I've attempted to make worked. Every sound that I've tried to place was placed in the right place. The level sounded good. The sound of the room sounded good. But like, you know, on the inverse, like when I played with Inquisition, I had no clue if it was a good set until I looked out after the set and saw that people were still in the room. It's like, oh, cool. I cleared about a third of the room out, but a third is still here. I'm like, that's all I care about. You know, we only need 13, 14 minutes of your time anyway. Stand through the 14 minutes of, you know, sonic blast, and you're pretty much good to go.
So you recently relocated from LA to Philly, is that right?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Philadelphia. It's where I've always considered home today.
That's rad. I guess the first thing I saw you post about that, and the first thing that came to my mind, I'm sure you've heard it from a million people, is the Hannibal Buress bit about get yourself together, man, move to Philly. Buy a loft, start a noise band, get six or seven roommates, eat hummus with them, book some gigs, smoke cloves, listen to Animal Collective, start a salsa company. I mean, you've got several of these things done. Are you going to start a salsa company?
You know, it's funny that GIF first appeared back when I lived here for the first time. That was probably more in parallel to my life then, because I didn't really know Crowhurst was going to be a big driving force in my life. It was just one of those things where I was, you know, a kid who had moved out back up north to college, and I didn't know what I was doing with my life. I could have done any of those things. Salsa company probably would have been much more lucrative. I definitely ate a lot of hummus because I was broke and I'm Middle Eastern, so if there's a can of chickpeas around and some olive oil and some garlic, I'll be all right. What Buress was trying to say there was pretty correct. It's like, just do shit. If you sit at home and you follow the rules of what you think you should be doing, if you take what everybody tells you to be Bond as Bond, then, I mean, you'll probably lead a pretty boring life. But if you just kind of go, well, I can get a house for under $1,000 and I can do some shit that seems kind of risky, but offset it by lowering day-to-day risks in my life, like rent and bills. And yeah, I mean, you know, you're going to have a much better time than if you're like, I'm going to go fucking spend 90% of my time busting ass so I can pay rent in a city or a house or and put myself in some sort of situation where it's supposed to be the it thing, you know, where this is where everything happens. Because where everybody tells you everything's happening, chances are not much is happening. It's like, if you go to a buffet and you line up 35 of the greatest foods all around the world, and then you have like 8 people in the room, I guarantee you there will be leftovers. You know, there's going to be food that goes uneaten. But if you get like 60 motherfuckers in a room with like four mediocre pizzas, those pizzas will be gone in a second.
I like the analogy.
Yeah, thanks. I would rather be a mediocre pizza in a room full of like 60, 70 motherfuckers. Because at least, you know, let me sit out for long enough that I gained a new flavor profile or something.
Goddamn.
That's now, deep. Is it Los Angeles pizza we're talking about or Philly pizza? Because there is a difference.
Wait, well, Los Angeles pizza is fucking garbage.
Yeah.
Unless you go King of New York on Wilshire Boulevard. King of New York is the best pizza in Los Angeles. If you're in Los Angeles and you like New York style pizza, go to King of New York Pizza on Wilshire Boulevard. They have a happy hour special where their pitchers are like $7 and you can't really get a $7 pitcher in Los Angeles. So it's good shit.
Damn. That's good.
Yeah. I'll plug the shit out of a pizza place if you get me a free slice. I don't know. But, hey, look, I'll take this whole podcast into the realm of just shilling like cheesesteaks and pokies and where's their good Indonesian food? I'm hungry. Like, I'll find it. We'll plug it. We'll get it out there. I give more of a shit on tour about where I'm eating than what I'm playing. I'm drinking this liquid that. Called Blue Wicked. It's got the color of Windex. Weird food is some of my favorite shit. I mean, Philly's the only place you can get really cotton candy soda at the bodega when you're purchasing cheesesteak egg rolls and blunt at 4 a.m.
So, wait, Blue Wicked, I just had to Google this. This is like, it looks like Extreme Zima or something like that.
Yeah, if I were to endorse any drink, it would be something that would be an extreme version of Zima.
I've heard Zima's back. I still need to track down a bottle or two.
Zima is back. When they decided that we were going to bring back Surge, Crystal Pepsi, Mountain Dew Pitch Black, I figured they thought, man, well, fuck it, throw Zima in the mix.
I'm hoping for a Tequiza. That was the tequila flavored malt beverage. It was horrifying. Absolutely horrifying.
Where do I get my hands on some tequila?
I think you got to go back to like 2002.
Oh man, is it hiding in a warehouse full of Fruitopia?
Probably, man.
The little soda with the plastic balls that are now banned.
Oh,
in the UK.
Shit! What was that called? Like Bits or something? There was a Z in that.
Orbits.
Yeah.
Orbits. They're like microdermabrasion beads inside of soda. if you really want like fresh, clear, healthy looking skin on the inside of your body, I would imagine drinking that would do it. But you know, then you can't go to the bathroom in the UK because dumping those into the sea is against the law now.
That is wild. So, you know. No idea.
Yeah, no orbits, no clean and clear. They're drawing a line in the fucking sand. But yeah, no, old sodas are great. Sometimes you can go into a corner store in Philadelphia and like, pull back two shelves and hidden under a layer of dust is like a thing of, you know, some test flavor of Mountain Dew. I'm like, what the fuck is this? Oh, it's been here. So, we're not clearing the shelves until somebody clears it off for us.
I know you've seen the movie Street Trash. I'm just imagining, you know, pulling back the shelves of Mountain Dew and finding a bottle of Tenafly Viper, and the entire homeless population of the city just melts.
Yeah, well, I mean, with the heat here recently, I'm pretty sure people would just blame the heat. I moved on the hottest day of the year, apparently, because I've got a grudge against myself. So the idea of drinking a questionable liquid and melting just seems like what I did about 8 days ago when the movers were here. Just, oh, well, let's go to the corner store, grab three bottles of whatever the cheapest malt beverage is, and hope for the best.
We sent you to go see the Emoji Movie. and you wrote a great post for Toilet of Hell about it. Unfortunately, the Emoji Movie, you know, your take on it was that it's just kind of an unspectacular thing. It wasn't, you know, a shit show. It wasn't, you know, really worth the time. Because, I mean, there's no way the movie was going to be any good, but it wasn't even bad enough to really warrant much of a reaction. And, I mean...
Yeah, it was... It had the same dazzling emotional effect as Johnny Depp in Rampo, which was about... It was pretty much next to nothing as far as charisma was. The only redeeming factor is when you make a movie that plays like a commercial, it ages like a commercial. So you're going to end up getting a nostalgia laugh out of the idea that, oh, weren't we funny? Well, we thought these would live forever. We thought these apps would live forever. I mean, the movie wasn't made to be consumed after its sell-by date. You know, that's the whole point of it. We create movies in 2017 in the same way that we created movies, you know, or independent filmmakers created movies when VHS became readily available to shoot on. We thought, well, fuck it, you know, everything's going to Netflix anyway, so we can't think about what are we going to do in DVD sales a year down the line. And it sucks because you get a lot less bad movies like Freddy Got Fingered, and a lot more bad movies like The Emoji.
That's interesting that you mentioned the format, though, because I feel like the advent of VHS brought us what is essentially the golden age of terrible cinema, where it suddenly became so cheap and so easy for anybody with a little bit of money to put out a movie that they did. I've got a buddy who has, you know, thousands upon thousands of VHS movies he just picks up from, you know, Salvation Army or wherever, just to see what's out there. You know, he has movie nights where we watch some of the worst things that he finds, and it's just fascinating how many movies were made with a whole host of people who were like, yes, this is a good idea, and the finished product is absolutely horrifying. I feel blessed that we have this wealth of film to consume that way.
Oh, I mean, I do too. I think, you know, I'm somebody who's a VHS collector myself. When I moved to Los Angeles, I actually helped the viral video pioneers, Everything is Terrible, digitize their tapes.
Hell yes.
They're great people. And I mean, this is, I would say VHS is still a gold mine. It's surprising how many films that you would think, like you said, who the fuck thought this was a good idea? And then you start going down the IMDb and you're like, oh, wow, that was the dude from The Karate Kid. Oh, wow, that was the dude from Big Trouble in Little China. Like, oh, wow, Shannon Tweed has been in every bad movie since the beginning of fucking time. But I mean... That's the beauty of it. By the way, that movie I'm referencing, Steel Justice, if anybody wants to look it up, it's on YouTube in full. STEELE Justice. But last night we did a double feature of Steel Justice and Shadow Warriors. Shadow Warriors is another Shannon Tweed film, but has Terry Hulk Hogan in it. And yeah, if you want to see a borderline unwatchable, like, but unwatchable in, you know, like turn it on while you're with a group of friends kind of way, movie is Shadow Warrior.
Hulk Hogan has been in a surprising number of awful, awful movies. I think on our last episode, we were talking about how he was both Suburban Commando and, what was it, Mr. Nanny?
Yes, he was. I have both of these films. he was in a lot of movies that were terrible, but it all goes back to No Holds Barred, his first film, a Shane McMahon features film, because I'm pretty sure Vince was like, oh, it'd be cute to name this after my son, not thinking that Shane O'Mac would be a pivotal figure in WWE's history after that. But
I think, I mean, Jordan, this is your shit, Jordan. Have you seen this one?
Of course. I saw it in theaters when I was a little kid.
Oh, whoa. That must have been an experience. How is seeing something like that in theaters?
Well, I was a big Hulkamaniac when I was a little kid, so I was just excited to see the guy that I really enjoyed up on the big screen pretty much doing the same thing he did on the little screen. It was just an extended wrestling match against Tiny Lister.
Yes, and Tiny Lister, they actually fought some of their better matches promoting the film on TV rather than in the film itself. But I mean, it's funny to think about how today, detached from Hulkamania, detached from watching him drop that big boot on people every single night and cutting weirdo promos, now we're decades and decades into professional wrestling and film and sports film. It's difficult to look at it with the same wonder or any even, you know, wrestling film with the same sense of wonder as we, you know, a child would seeing, you know, No Holds Barred for the first time. But it also frames into context, you know, those John Cena movies and you know, The Rock and the Tooth Fairy. Because yeah, then you think about, well, you know, what was he doing on the screen at the time? Well, he was being a big fucking goofball. Well, what is he doing here? He's being a big fucking goofball.
I was a kid when I saw, I think it was Ready to Rumble with fucking Dewey.
The WCW movie.
Yeah, with fucking Dewey from Scream. Is that guy's name?
David Arquette.
David Arquette, yeah.
David Arquette.
I got the same kind of sensation. I was young enough. I was so into, you know, the WCW at the time. Like, I was like, this is fantastic, even though it is an objectively terrible movie. I wonder how much of how much film is made, like, with children in mind, that, like, it's just meant for that moment. You, on your Emoji Movie article, posted this thing that was just mesmerizing to me. Cool Cat Saves the Day.
Cool Cat Saves the Kid.
Cool Cat Saves the Kids. Please tell us a little bit about this and how you found it.
There's two types of kids' movies. Like, John Lovitz put it best when he was talking about how critics panned Little Nicky. Like, everybody hated Little...
I liked that movie.
I loved it. I think this is probably my favorite Adam Sandler movie, as an adult, at least. And I think as a teenager, it was definitely pretty high up there. But Lovitz was talking about how everybody was just bagging on him and just talking about it being awful. I mean, keep in mind, this was the critic saying, you know, getting bagged on by critics. And when asked about how he felt, he's like, I don't give a fuck what some, like, you know, 39-year-old, 45-year-old professional film watcher thinks of this movie, because I didn't make it for them. I made this with the idea of making some 15-year-old boy laugh his ass off. And if you look at the box office, it seems like I did a pretty good job. And that, you know, it really, that quote kind of sums it up. You know, there are movies that are intended to make 15-year-old boys laugh and not intended to be good movies. And then there are movies that are intended to make everybody, you know, pander to everybody's needs. And they are the ones that usually end up falling completely flat or have very little watchability. Cool Cat Saves the Kids falls into that second category of, we tried to do a movie for everybody, and nobody ended up happy. I think it was like Vivica A. Fox and fucking Eric Estrada are in it.
They were definitely in that clip. I was like, oh, wow. Vivica A., what are you doing?
That's one of the harsher movies I've had to encounter. I love trying to find movies that are almost endurance tests. There's a fake version of the B movie called Plan B, which is my, if you thought B movie was great, then you're probably not going to want to watch Plan B because it's bastardization. If you thought B movie was bad, holy shit, you will fucking wretch. I mean, it's kind of like if you took visually, it's like a very long PlayStation 1 demo cutscene. And then plot-wise, it's like if you took the entire plot B-movie and then had it rewritten by an 11-year-old and told them, like, okay, it's Wednesday. Thursday, you need to do this for your homework. You know, you have it turned in. And they're like, oh, okay, all right. You know, so they did that, and then they took that page that they handed in to the teacher, and the teacher didn't even read it, just put it into Google Translate, translated it to Korean, then translated it back to English, and then got it. So it's incoherent, but that's the gradient, man. There's like at the top of the unwatchable chain is Plan B. Then after that, there's After Last Season, which is pretty deep into the realm of bad movies. Just after that, there's Food Fight. Food Fight is Food Fight something. Food Fight is a movie that was written, and I believe 90% of the film, or a good percentage of the film, was made. And then some employees stole the hard drive that the movie was on, so they had to remake the movie. Charlie Sheen plays a crime-fighting detective dog that is trapped inside a supermarket. In the supermarket, all the characters, the brand characters, come to life. And this ties back into the Emoji Movie, because the whole point of Food Fight was that they were going to have the whole supermarket's worth of brands, and the companies would pay to have the brands featured in the film. So Mr. Clean would be walking around, the Hawaiian Punch guy would be walking around. You know, you would be able to get these brands pushed. But
yeah, I'm looking at the cover really here. It's got like Twinkie the Kid, the Vlasic Stork or whatever the fuck that bird is, and the tuna, Charlie Tuna, and there's some big names associated with this. Charlie Sheen's the main character. You got Wayne Brady, Hilary Duff, Eva Longoria, all in this what appears to be, it looks like this also looks like a PS1 game.
It's slightly above PS1 quality. But there's some seriously like jarring scenes in there where you're like, why? Like, it's some coked up 42-year-old's idea of what an 8-year-old would like. No, I'm not thinking more like Leisure Suit Larry. You know, like, what? Why? There's no reason to. Okay, well, I guess you're doing it. No, like, you have the money, so you're pulling the strings. And then after Food Fight comes Cool Cat Saves the Kids, because it is almost watchable. In the sense that you can, again, you could put it on with friends and you can dissect it. And there's a lot of things where you're just like, this was a decision. This was a conscious decision, not by a team of people, but like by two wealthy people. Two wealthy people who had no idea what the fuck they were doing. They were just like, well, we're going to make a movie for kids. You know, I think that it's easy to find shit like this. You could just look on YouTube. That Food Fight movie is available in its entirety on YouTube. I think Cool Cat Saves the Kids is not. I saw a download of it from a pirate site, but I purchased the DVD because it's so crazy. But you can watch. You can basically watch it with commentary online on YouTube.
This is fascinating. I just got to see it. God, seriously, though, God bless rich people that decide to just make movies. I mean, there's so many horrible things that you can do with your wealth, and instead, you know, you create the next The Room or something like that.
Well, I mean, it's the gift that keeps on giving. I mean, look, Jerry Lewis just died. He made the Day the Clown Cried.
I want to see this so bad. Surely it's going to be released one day, right? Actually, okay. for our audience that might not be familiar, you should describe The Day the Clown Cried.
Okay, well, there was a period where, I don't know if a lot of the listeners are familiar with Jerry Lewis's highly abrasive form of humor, but if you read any article on Jerry Lewis in his personal life and how he treated people, he was not a good dude. He was a very, very dark dude, and he took a lot of his comedic cues from Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, and as someone who is Jewish and who had a strong bit of Jewish identity, but also wanted to play with the taboos of humor, there was a long time where he was fixated on making Holocaust comedy. And The Day the Clown Cried and Which Way to the Front are his two attempts at Holocaust comedy. Which Way to the Front was released and is considered widely to be Lewis's worst film. But The Day the Clown Cried was not even released. It's for a long time, it was rumored to have not even been finished. But then I think Hank Azaria is the guy who's the voice of Homer Simpson. He apparently saw it and said it was a train wreck. And then a couple of years ago, Lewis donated the only existing print in its entirety to Library of Congress or something like that, or something along those lines, and said it's to be released in like 2023 or a couple of years after his death, whichever comes first. And now that he's a fucking dead guy, we're going to get to see his fabled, you know, rich guy making a poorly executed idea of a comedy movie.
Just the very concept of this, I mean, it takes some stones to say I'm going to make a Holocaust comedy. And from hearing the plot that I have, that this guy is a Jewish clown who is meant to, like, basically entertain children and leading them into their death. For the Nazis, that is about the harshest concept you can try to think of to make jokes with. So
I mean, have you heard of Jacob the Liar?
That was Robin Williams, right?
Yeah, that was Jacob the Liar and Life is Beautiful came out around the same time, and for some reason somebody in Hollywood was like, let's make a bunch of Holocaust comedies again. And Roberto Benigni won the fucking Oscar for his. But
I remember him clapping like an asshole. I've never seen the movie, though.
The thing about that movie was that when Roberto Benigni jumped over a bunch of fucking chairs at the Oscars, he kind of overshadowed that whole movie he wrote. But it's probably for the best, because it's a funny movie about the Holocaust. So maybe we can just gloss over that. maybe we could gloss over anything that reminds us that Robin Williams made the movie Jacob the Liar. Because that was, whew, oh boy. That's like one of those movies that, like, when I think about it, I have to turn the AC on because I start to sweat.
Oh.
It's that bad. And I'm not going to go into it. I'm just going to say, if you're posting links to shit, post a link to the flyer. To the trailer for that. By God, man. One view of the trailer will just leave you going like, but why? Why? Why?
This is must-see. This is a must-see trailer now. Like, I'm extremely intrigued.
I would say what makes it so preposterous, because I love, as somebody who loves bad movies, I think, again, it's important to categorize them in, like, there's movies that are like Cool Cat Saves the Kids, that are just, you know, you take one look at them and go, oh, that seems like a bad idea made by one person who could clearly hire two stars. And then there's movies like Food Fight where they're like, oh, somewhere along the line, the execution of this got botched. And that's why this is so bad. But Jacob the Liar, like you said in the beginning, a team of people had to think, okay, this is good. And this is like teams and teams of people making the movie they thought would be really good. It wasn't like there was production holdups that made it bad. It wasn't like Waterworld where they went $1 billion, you know, dollars of budget, and there was a bunch of bad luck. The problem with this was that the movie itself is just shit. You know, no amount of bad luck would have made this movie worse because it's as bad as it could possibly fucking be. But yeah, I didn't think I would have to go into like some of the worst movies I've ever seen. But whew, Jacob the Liar, man, that's enough to make you want to go into therapy.
Well, shit. I will be
sorry, sure. I mean, you can really.
No, that is great. I'm going to be sure to include a link to the trailer for any curious parties that want to hurt themselves.
Yeah, I take no responsibility. Watch at your own risk.
Jordan, what do you think the worst movie you've ever seen is?
Well, it is important to have the distinction of like a movie you really don't like versus like an actually bad, not, you know, a bad movie, because I have plenty of movies that I've seen that I've absolutely hated that like were high quality, a lot of money are put into it, there's real actors, stuff like that. If that was the case, the movie would be The Tree of Life from Terrence Malick. I don't know if either of you have ever heard of it.
Heard of it? Oh, never. Yeah. Seen it.
It's like 2.5 hours long. I'm looking at the IMDb page. I could read the 2-sentence summary of it right now for you. The story of a family in Waco, Texas in 1956. The eldest son witnesses the loss of innocence and struggles with his parents' conflicting teachings. And this is almost 2.5 hours long. It's nothing. Nothing happens. I saw it in like a movie theater full of people. I almost screamed out, make it stop.
Terrence Malick has a tendency to take you on. He's like a train operator who wants to take you through the most monotonous fucking train exercises and won't let you get out of the train. And sorry, we're on the tracks. It's dangerous. But here, we're going to, for the next 2.5 hours, we're going to be discussing the American West and the different types of sand that are available in the American West. And he gives you a ride that's just bumpy enough that you can't fall asleep, but just boring enough so that you want to tear your fucking eyeballs out of your head. He does best when he's discussing things that are like the Thin Red Line or Thin Blue Line. He made a fucking war movie, The Thin Something Line. I'm probably getting that title wrong, but I know he made a fucking war movie that was great, but I remember it being great because his whole thing was like war itself has a degree of horrifying monotony to it. And he directed a bunch of, I remember he apparently directed 8 hours of acting from some super like big actor in that movie, like Tom Cruise. And then he got about 5 minutes of dialogue in it. Malick is known for shooting like 16, 17 hours of film and then editing it down to like 2.5 hours. But, you know, it's hard to not pace your movie like fucking Begotten when you're filming 14 hours of shit. It's like, okay, well, what are you trying to get across? Are you trying to get across that you're a painter? Or are you trying to get across a story because you're a fucking filmmaker? And unfortunately, like with Tree of Life, it's like staring at a Monet for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and, you know, trying to come up with the story yourself. Oh, they're all having a picnic. you know, it's just God. I can't imagine seeing that in theaters.
Yeah, I'd take Begotten any day over The Tree of Life. It was beautifully shot. You know, it had real actors in it, but it literally half the movie is like the creation of the planet. And I don't know why.
Yeah, if you conceptually, you had a problem with the film as well?
I didn't understand what was going on for most of it. Like, I didn't know characters' names. The movie had a tendency to have the characters narrate just whispering random nothingness, like, "Mother, where were you?" while you're looking at, like, volcanoes explode.
That just reminds me of that scene in South Park where they all go to Sundance, and it's like, I don't want to watch independent films. It's a bunch of gay cowboys eating pudding. No, it's not. And then they cut to later, and they're in an art house film, and it's just a bunch of gay cowboys eating pudding. And Cartman's like, "I knew it! I knew this is what they were!" Like, that's how I feel about Terrence Malick movies, is that he's watched so many shitty entry-level film school films and short films, and he's like the dude who, after the whole day of final assignments are given to the class, and, you know, or presented in front of the class, everybody reads out their essays, and then, all right, you know, next day, tomorrow we go through the rest of the students. And he comes up, and his, you know, essay is an amalgamation of all the best parts of the previous day's essays. You're like, oh, okay. I see what you're doing there. You use the same big word as the other dude used. I'm not quite sure if you're using it correctly, but you definitely used it. You know, so, but bless Malick, when he fucking hits, he hits hard, but it's just like he made his most recent film. He made some movie about South by Southwest and just got it so wrong. Like, South by Southwest is mostly just, you know, rich people at parties talking about vapid shit. Like, no, not at all. It's mostly people waiting around for the Doritos Lady Gaga halftime show and people wondering where the fuck to pick up their badges.
Yeah, I've lived in Austin the last 12 years. I saw that he was making this movie. I was like, there's no fucking way I'm ever going to see this. South by Southwest is kind of like my own personal hell in a lot of ways.
That's what everybody in Austin tells me. They're like, it's the worst time of the year. Yeah, it's seemingly the only time of the year that I'm there. Which I think that's the issue, is not me personally, but that's everybody comes to Austin at the same time, and they put up giant, you know, carnival rides and shit, and people are like, wow, Austin's great, and everybody, I think, at least from what I've heard, everybody's like, no, this is not Austin, this is South by Southwest.
Yeah, I mean, well, to be fair, it is the only part of the year that you can drink in the street and not really have anybody, you know, yell at you for it, which is kind of nice. But I mean, like, there's just so many people crammed into one little area, and like, it's just a logistical nightmare, and it's suffocating. Especially, like, a friend of mine was killed a couple of years ago when some dude like drove through a big crowd of people during South by Southwest, and just I gotta stay away from it whenever possible now.
I remember when that happened. I think that was one of the catalysts for there being not as many unofficial South by Southwest events.
And it's a shame, really, because like I saw like Knocked Mystium in a bar the size of my living room, one South by Southwest, and like Magruder Grind in a room the size of my kitchen. There used to be a lot of really great unofficial shows, and they're slowly stamping those out so that there can be more Doritos Locos Lady Gaga sets.
Yeah, I remember some of my best shows were South by Southwest Fests, where, you know, we were fortunate enough to get a good spot and played a really big room, bigger than I'm used to. Or at least was used to at the time, and played to more people than I was used to at the time. You know, it's a dangerous spot, though, because it becomes this weird hedonistic paradise, but in fucking Texas. So yeah, there's a bit of a juxtaposition. you know, you're like, oh, I want to take all the drugs I want, do all that. But, you know, also if I get caught, it's a really big deal where, you know, I think if you went someplace like California, you're like, oh, well, I'm going to go to a music festival and there's going to be lots of drugs. You don't really need to worry about anything. It's a tourist city. You kind of park and ride. Whereas in Austin, I found that during South by Southwest, fuck if you're going to get an Uber. It's wall to wall fucking drunk pieces of shit who can't drive. I swear to God, it's like if it were driving only during Mardi Gras in New Orleans, it would be South by Southwest.
Just wanted to touch back on a thing. You said that you worked with the dudes from Everything Is Terrible for a spell, helping them digitize things, right?
Yeah, for a little while. They're really good people. Brian and Dimitri are the people I got to know best. Dimitri works for like Memory Hole now and does a lot of incredible stuff, Super Deluxe. And I mean, Brian has, in my opinion, the greatest musical project I've heard in my life, Country Death.
I love Everything Is Terrible. I have like a ton of their DVDs, but it kills me watching some of the, like the children's Christian programming. I grew up in a super religious environment. So like seeing Gerbert, like I had Gerbert VHS tapes as a kid. So it's a trip to scroll through my Facebook feed and see Everything Is Terrible posting one of those.
Man, I mean, there's so much bad Christian media put out because I think the whole idea that Christian parents were only supposed to show their kids Christian programming for a little while, that meant that there was going to be a lot of Christian programming. So you got stuff like Bible Man.
Oh, hell yeah. With Willie... God, what was his? He was
from Charles in Charge.
From Charles in Charge, yeah.
Yeah, the dude. I believe he got busted for some sort of hard drugs at some point.
That's not very Bible Man of him.
Yeah, I think it was like crack cocaine, and then it might have been like something like child pornography and crack cocaine. Oh. Something really egregious. Like, I don't know about the child pornography part, but it just seems like it would fall under in line with. The secret double life of Bible Man, crack, watching like terrible, morally dubious porn. You know, it's kind of like when you find out the dude who ran the indie wrestling promotion from the 80s that you like died covered in cocaine and Vaseline in the top floor of a prostitute-filled high-rise in a police shootout.
Who is this? Who is that?
I remember that episode of Glow.
It's funny because I think it was post-Glow. I think it was the UWF.
Universal, yeah.
Yeah, the dude who ran the UWF. I could be wrong. Yeah. But I believe that was the dude who... was covered in cocaine and Vaseline in a shootout in a high rise.
Yeah, he was like running around naked in a hotel at one point.
Yeah. Was that really in Glow?
That wasn't in Glow. That was Universal.
Oh, I was going to say, like, if the Glow TV show covered that, I may need to watch this Glow TV show.
Maybe the next season they're doing a second one.
Oh, my God. You know, I have my problems with... Have you ever watched the actual Glow TV show?
I have.
I've seen a few episodes, yeah.
No, I mean, like, not the docuseries. Like,
yeah, old one with, like, Ninochka and Mount Fuji and all that.
Yeah, there's a bunch of them on YouTube. I first came across it from, like, a Lost and Found Video Night DVD, like, 15 years ago or so.
Oh, yeah. It's so bad. It's, like, almost unwatchable. The idea that it would be like this was put on TV alongside like normal wrestling. So it's weird to think that there were some people who were growing up thinking, oh, well, this is what just what wrestling is. You know, it was back before people were aware that wrestling, like it was not in the collective consciousness that wrestling was predetermined. So people or that, you know, if you people thought that, like, if the Iron Sheik was feuding with, Hulk Hogan, then if you met the Iron Sheik in a bar, he would be upset about some Hulk Hogan shit, you know, but, you know, you wouldn't think that he was just some guy.
Was it, in the 80s that Jake the Snake broke, like, John Stossel's nose or some shit?
That was Dr. Yeah. D. Dave Schultz.
Well,
he hand-slapped him really hard.
Yeah, well, Jake the Snake also had a lot of drug and alcohol problems. It's kind of like, I mean, Hulk Hogan busted Richard Belzer's head once when Richard Belzer implied that wrestling was not real.
Yeah,
he didn't imply it. He was like, "Oh, isn't wrestling fake?" And it was Mr. T and Hulk Hogan. They were going on Belzer to promote WrestleMania, and Belzer was goading them on. And Belzer's like, "Hey, could you show me a move?" And Hogan put Belzer into a front chin lock, but because he's got 22-inch pythons, brother, it came off more like a choke. And Belzer's eyes rolled into the back of his head, and you know, Hogan let go, and Belzer dropped like a fucking stone. You know, cracked his head on the stage, and sued Hogan, settled, and purchased a house in France he called Chez Hogan.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's another fun wrestling story of, that was kayfabe back then. If you were exposing the business, it was a bad thing. And Glow kind of fell under the category, at least for me, and I know for a lot of other people, as almost making fun of the business. I mean, it's hard to look at, like, Captain Lou Albano and then think anybody was trying to, you know, mock that. You know, it's like, I'm pretty sure Lou Albano is the top of the league of why, you know, like really? Are you guys making yourself? All right. Lou Albano was definitely, like, the top of the league of, for me at least, of, like, are you intentionally making fun of yourself, or is this a real character?
You know, he was so out of his mind on drugs and alcohol too. So it's always hard to tell with him. I mean, he was also Super Mario in that TV show in the 90s.
Yeah, the Super Mario Brothers Super Show.
Yep.
Which was, I mean, that show ruled. That show was pivotal in introducing people like Sergeant Slaughter and Rowdy Roddy Piper to kids. I think that was a gateway for so many people. I remember being a very, very little kid and my dad showing that, not really understanding the significance of, like, oh, that was Lou Albano. But my dad was also of the, like, he was of the generation that watched Haystacks Calhoun and, you know,
the big stiffs of the 70s.
Oh yeah. You know, my dad would be like, "Oh, you eat too much, you'll be buried in a piano case like Haystacks Calhoun." I'm like 8 and I don't know who Haystacks Calhoun is. I just know I don't want to be buried in a piano case because that sounds like a large man. And then I got older and I was like, holy shit. I can only imagine being like a little kid and turning on the TV and seeing that giant man. But then I think about it in retrospect now, I'm like, I was watching Juggalo Championship Wrestling with Hornswoggle and Hillbilly and, you know, like different giant indie wrestlers who had fat gimmicks too. So I don't know. It's all a cycle, that wrestling storytelling seems to all be this one fantastic cycle, but Glow doesn't seem to fit in really well for me because it just felt too much like a TV show.
Yeah, it was a variety show that happened to have wrestling in it, really.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to come off of the idea of even a show with Lou Albano promos to like vaudevillian wrestling. That seemed like a bit of a stretch to me.
Were you all just talking about the Super Mario Brothers show?
Yeah, yes. The Super Mario Brothers Super Show with Captain Lou Albano.
Shit ruled, man. What was the deal? Like, Captain Lou Albano was also like Cyndi Lauper's dad in all of those videos.
The whole thing with Cyndi Lauper and their obsession with WWE's obsession with let's get pop culture to push, you know, pro wrestling into the cultural mental forefront. I mean, it worked. Cyndi Lauper, obviously now Cyndi Lauper and, you know, plays like a more classed up version of Tiffany, but it's still like she's still about as 80s as dangly earrings, you know, and bracelet, giant plastic bracelets. Like she aged worse than Albano culturally.
Damn.
At least it's true. I mean, I think about how many people I know watch Captain Lou Albano promos unironically versus how many people I know listen to Cyndi Lauper unironically.
Fair point.
And I'm like, well, Albano, you know, they were playing characters. I think that, you know, any pop star has to play a character. It's like if you want to tie it into current stuff, you know, they have that feud between Ryan Adams and Father John Misty.
I am all in for this feud.
It's kind of like when I have friends who get really angry at like current pro wrestling stuff. And they're like, I can't believe, you know, Lana and Rusev got married. They hated each other, blah, blah, blah. And like, I got to be like, dude. They're playing characters. Like, John Misty revealed himself as a character pretty quick when he did a fucking eulogy for the animals, for the animatronic band at Chuck E. Cheese.
Oh, yeah.
And it wasn't like... Oh, go ahead.
People might not, like, know if they didn't look into it before, but, like, Father John Misty used to be the drummer in fucking Fleet Foxes, otherwise known as the softest band of all time. So he's just some, like, indie dude who decided to, like, mix it up a little bit. And, it's you know, personally, I find it insufferable, but I think that might be kind of, like, the point.
Yeah, I mean, that is the point, I think. I think the whole idea behind it was that he must have been the drummer for Fleet Foxes for so long and dealt with so many insufferable pricks that he was like, I am going to create a character out of parody that is the ultimate prick. That is like the ultimate, you know, giant Yodorowsky hat wearing, fucking, you know, singing songs with Lana Del Rey, you know, wearing a... He is, you know what he is? He is to 2017 what Pete Doherty of the Libertines was in 2009. Where everybody's like, that fedora wearing fucking, you know, like Dayton Kate Moss always doing coke hipster motherfucker. Like, he's just the symbol for everything that was wrong with that generation. Father John Misty was trying to hit all those points, but then it's a fucking joke. Like, the whole point, I refuse to believe that that man doesn't like take off the fake beard when he goes home and like puts on, you know, goes ahead and he like puts on two Procol Harum records and smokes like a big fat joint and laughs his ass off at like Ryan Adams' angry tweets. Like, you fucking bought it, you know, like dudes who really believe that like Captain Lou Albano was a captain, you know, those are the people who get angry at Father John Misty. people who believe that, like, fucking Hacksaw Jim Duggan always carried around a 2x4 with probably would believe. I don't think he would carry around a 2x4. It's not like New Jack, who would, like, punched a girl in the face for giving him a 7-Up when he asked for a Sprite.
Jordan, you've written about him before.
Yeah, New Jack is amazing, and I will never say a bad word about him for fear of my own safety, because he has, I believe, either 3 or 4 confirmed kills.
Jesus.
Yeah.
He was a bounty hunter for a while.
He's a serious dude. Yeah, I was supposed to have him cut a promo for 2 that was supposed to be like that ECW Harlem promo that he shot. I told him to come to my hood. That promo. But the problem was the label who was going to pay for it kind of got stuck in a bind. They're like, well, what if he doesn't do the promo? What are we going to do? The new Jack will just have our money.
Yep.
like, are you going to go after New Jack if he doesn't cut the promo by the time the record's released? Like, he's fucking New Jack. So they pushed out on it.
Yeah, I wrote about New Jack for, I think, the top 10 most metal moments in professional wrestling history. And he was number one for throwing Vic Grimes off of scaffolding through about 30 tables and viciously hurting him.
I thought you were going to bring up the mass transit incident.
That too, where I think I mentioned that, where he sliced this untrained kid's forehead with an X-Acto knife, and it was pretty much a geyser of blood shooting out of this kid's forehead.
Ooh. Yeah, this kid who was put in at the last minute and like wasn't really aware of what would happen. This was not like a Zach Gowen situation where you're like, oh, okay, this is a dude who is inherently aware of the risks of what he's doing. I'm pretty sure, I think his name was Mass Transit, his wrestling name.
Yeah, it was.
I'm pretty sure Mass Transit was not aware that he was getting in the ring with the world's most dangerous man. Going in with Kurt Ballou to record 3, at some point, we were going to record it at the beginning of this year, but new Converge record kind of takes precedent over my regular shit.
I'd rather listen to you than Converge.
You haven't heard 3 yet. Everything we've recorded 3 sounds ridiculous. All in all, man, I mean, it's mostly done, and it's very interesting. There's technical elements in it. I've got a collaboration with End User in the works, collaboration with other companies. Now, a year and a half, 2 years, we've been working on this fucking thing. So there's that. So there's lots of words. September, November, my first noise record, of new material, first record material. Record goes to shelter in you a video. I hope I'm saying the last name right. We did this Cuban orchestra, brand new.
Someone else, and then now try to imagine the worst thing that person has ever done. Now weigh your worst thing versus their worst thing. Who comes out more evil? That's my first question. My second question is, why did you do that horrible thing? Don't worry about it. It's probably not important. Seriously, just let it go now. Don't dwell on it. I mean, there's multiple variables that go into every situation, so there's a good chance it's not even your fault. Change the memory. Let it go. I mean, unless it's something really bad. Did you kill multiple people? killed one person, I would ask you who, and then judge whether or not it was bad depending on who you killed. But if you killed multiple people, I would still say let it go. Seriously. Either turn yourself in or go on the run. Either way is going to be a hell of a story. And that's all you really wanted to accomplish anyway, right? That's why you did all that horrible stuff for the sake of the story. Right?
You're listening to 66.6 FM. Radio TOVH. The Flush.